One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, we have reports from Dan Friedel and John Russell. We close the show with our American History Program, The Making of a Nation. But first, here's Joe Robbins.
Chinese officials urged people to avoid traveling home for the Lunar New Year observance to prevent spreading the coronavirus in rural areas. China reported its biggest one-day jump in COVID cases in more than 5 months on Wednesday. Efforts to contain the new wave of infections include a lockdown of 4 cities. Most of the new cases were reported near the capital, Beijing. But an area in the far northeast also reported a rise in infections. More than 28 million people are under home quarantine. Heilongjiang province on Wednesday declared a COVID-19 emergency. The city of Suihua, next to the provincial capital Harbin, put its 5.2 million people under lockdown. Tianli, a city of about 300,000 that borders Suihua, said on Wednesday it would ban people and vehicles from leaving for 3 days as part of new COVID-19 prevention measures. Officials said Wednesday that local health centers and hospitals in villages need to watch carefully for any new COVID-19 cases. The government is preparing for the world's largest yearly movement of people. Hundreds of millions of Chinese usually travel home for Lunar New Year break in February. Many of those traveling are workers in cities who go back to their home villages. Officials in some places have asked those workers to stay where they are. Wang Bin is an official with the National Health Commission. Wang told a news conference, "In the period leading up to Lunar New Year, we urge the public that those who do not need to travel should not travel." Wang added that those who must travel should do it at times that are not very busy, wear face coverings, and avoid crowded places with lots of people. In Hebei province, the city of Shijiazhuang has most of the recent virus cases. On Wednesday, the Health Commission in Hebei announced another 90 confirmed cases. Shijiazhuang ordered its roughly 10 million people to take a second round of tests for the virus. The officials want to isolate the sources of infection, some of which may be coming from wedding gatherings. Testing rates are at 12.55 million people each day, or 10 times the level last March. The total number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in mainland China is about 87,706. The official death toll is at least 4,634. The Hebei outbreak worries officials because the province is close to Beijing. Travel to and from 3 cities is not permitted. The cities are Shijiazhuang, Xingtai, and Langfang. People living in some communities have to stay home for the next week. Feng Zijian is deputy director of the Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He told reporters that a massive increase in infections is unlikely during the holiday if people obey control and prevention measures. On December 15th, China started a vaccination campaign for some groups. Officials said Wednesday that health workers have given over 10 million doses of one of the COVID-19 vaccines produced in China. Currently, China has only approved one vaccine for people age 18 to 59. It is from state-owned Sinopharm. China has also approved 3 vaccines for emergency use, including 2 from Sinopharm and 1 from Sinovac, a private company. World Health Organization, or WHO, experts arrived in China last week to begin studying the origins of the pandemic. Chinese officials said they would work closely with the WHO in their research. The WHO head criticized the Chinese government for slow approval of the necessary permissions for their investigation. The team will have to spend 14 days in quarantine. China has strongly controlled all research into the origins of the coronavirus. State media has promoted theories that someone brought the virus to China from outside. A health expert with the WHO said earlier that they did not expect that the team would reach a final opinion from its trip. I'm Jill Robbins.
Hundreds of thousands of people normally attend a new American president's inauguration. But the first day of Joe Biden's presidency will be very different. Because of the coronavirus crisis, the official presidential swearing-in ceremony, to be held January 20th, was already going to be more low-key. But after the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, heightened security measures will also be in place, and crowds will be further limited. A high-security area is being established around the Capitol, the White House, and the National Mall. The U.S. Secret Service is in charge of the inauguration. Michael Plotty is the agent in charge. He said to help deal with possible security threats, there will be increased communication between local and federal police. His agency will also cooperate closely with the Department of Defense and Homeland Security officials. Plotty said he sees the inauguration and the attack on the U.S. Capitol as 2 very different events. For example, he said the inauguration is planned far in advance. Unlike what happened at the Capitol on January 6th, agencies have plans in place to prevent possible violence. In addition to local and federal police officers, there will be 10,000 National Guard soldiers on duty. Earlier, the coronavirus was the main concern ahead of this year's inauguration. Now, the combination of possible violence and the continued spread of the virus across the U.S. will make this one of the most unusual inaugurations ever. There will be no large crowds. President-elect Biden will make his way from the Capitol to the White House, but it will not be in the usual public parade. Instead, this will be a virtual event that people can watch online and on television. Many of the traditional speeches and warm wishes that go along with an inauguration will also be completed online. There will not be a special celebration, known as a ball, that night. That event will also happen online and on television. Organizers say the events will center around the subject America United. Throughout his campaign for president, Biden has talked about being a president for all the people and has suggested he will seek to heal a nation divided by major political disputes. Hollywood actor Tom Hanks will host a special television event to welcome Biden to the White House. Musical performances will be given by Justin Timberlake, John Bon Jovi, and Demi Lovato. Here is an example of how few people will attend the inauguration. Usually, each member of Congress receives about 40 tickets to be given to friends and supporters from their states to attend. Under that system, at least 20,000 special visitors were invited to come to the inauguration. This year, each member of Congress gets only 2 tickets. That adds up to just over 1,000 guests. In most years, people without tickets were permitted to watch the ceremony on the National Mall, the large public area that stretches from the Capitol building to the Lincoln Memorial. But this year, the National Park Service is urging people to stay home. The Washington Monument, the famous centerpiece that rises above the mall, will be closed. There will, however, be a representation of all of the people who usually attend the inauguration. There will be nearly 200,000 U.S. flags planted in the ground, along with a display of 56 high-powered lights. The lights will represent the U.S. states and territories. One person is definitely staying home, President Donald Trump. The outgoing leader, who was impeached for the second time last week, has said he will not attend. Vice President Mike Pence will be there. So will former Presidents Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. Biden will lead the small group to Arlington National Cemetery in Virginia to lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier. Tony Allen is in charge of Biden's inaugural committee. He said the goal of this year's inaugural activities is to show the nation that we are stronger together than we are apart. Biden is set to take the oath of office on January 20th, at noon. I'm John Russell.
Maple and oak trees with branches full of seeds at the end of summer got American plant expert Lee Reich thinking about how trees grow. He remembers how, a few years ago, he decided to drop an apple seed into some soil he had placed in a small container. Reich imagined his small seed would turn into a beautiful apple tree. But it didn't work out. The seed germinated and started growing. But then it stopped growing when it was just 10 centimeters tall. How come? Reich said most seeds that come from colder parts of the world need special treatment before they will grow. He found out that he was lucky his seed grew at all. Reich now knows how to grow a tree from seeds. When those seeds fall from the branches of tall trees, they cannot start growing right away. Reich noted that the young trees would die during the cold winter if they start growing immediately. So, most seeds know how to stay asleep during the winter until warmer weather comes. That is when they can grow well. But if you do not want to wait all winter for your seeds to grow, Reich has some suggestions. Reich said you can fool the seed into starting to grow. The way to do this is by placing the seeds into plastic bags filled with potting soil that is a little wet. Then put the bags into a cool place, like a garage or refrigerator. The process is known as stratification. It is important to keep the seeds cool but not too cold for a few months. The temperature needs to be above freezing, but below 10 degrees Celsius. Reich said, "You might have a little more work to do before stratification, depending on what kind of seed you are growing. Harder seeds first need to be softened to let water get in. Such hard seeds come from redbud, juniper, and hornbeam trees. To get water inside the seed, you need to nick them with a small, sharp object. The other way to soften a seed's hard shell is to put them in soil and leave them in a warm room for 2 or 3 months. Then you can begin stratification. Once the seeds are stratified and conditions are right, they will start to grow roots. For sugar maple trees, it might take 3 months. For apple seeds, it might take only 2 months. But Reich shares a warning. Don't forget about your stratifying seeds. 1 week, he said, they could be asleep. The next week, they could have fat, white roots. Once your seeds start to grow roots, you can put them in a container or a pot. Or, if you are not ready, keep them somewhere cool until you are ready to plant them outdoors. Reich noted that some people may wonder what the point is of all this trouble when you can just buy a small tree at a garden center. "You're a gardener. You like to grow plants," he explained. Reich also said how satisfying it is to look up, after many years, at a tall tree that you once started from just a seed. I'm Dan Friedel.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Shirley Griffith and Larry West continue the story of the peace conference following World War I.
American President Woodrow Wilson was one of the chief negotiators at the conference in Paris. Throughout the early months of 1919, he struggled hard for a treaty that would result in peace with justice for all sides. Wilson demanded a treaty that provided for a new international organization. He called it the League of Nations. To Wilson, the League was more important than any other part of the treaty. Not all Americans shared Wilson's opinion. Many feared the League would take away the power of the American government to declare war and make treaties. They also agreed with the leaders of the other Allied nations. Establishing the League was less important than punishing the defeated enemy.
The other major Allied leaders at the peace conference were Prime Minister David Lloyd George of Britain, Premier Georges Clemenceau of France, and Premier Vittorio Otto of Italy. Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and Otto understood how much Wilson wanted the League of Nations. They used this knowledge to win Wilson's approval for other parts of the peace treaty. Wilson soon learned that to get the League, he had to compromise on many issues. For example, he had to accept British and French demands to make Germany pay all war damages. The payments added up to more than $300,000,000. Wilson also had to accept the Allied takeover of Germany's colonies.
Some of Wilson's compromises violated his belief in self-determination. This was the right of all people to decide for themselves who would govern them. One compromise, for example, gave to Japan Germany's colonial rights in the Shantung area of China. China protested the decision. It asked that control of Shantung be returned to the Chinese government. But President Wilson needed Japan's support for the League of Nations, so he accepted Japan's demand for control of Shantung. There were other violations of the policy of self-determination. For example, 3 million Germans were made citizens of the new nation of Czechoslovakia. Millions of other Germans were forced into the newly formed nation of Poland. And Italy received territory that had belonged to Austria.
Today, most history experts agree Woodrow Wilson was correct in opposing these decisions. They say Germany's loss of territory and citizens caused deep bitterness, and the bitterness helped lead to the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. In East Asia, Japanese control over parts of China created serious tensions. Both decisions helped plant the seeds for the bloody harvest of World War II 20 years later. But Allied leaders at the Paris Peace Conference were not looking far into the future. As one person said at the time, they divided Europe like people cutting up a tasty pie.
After months of negotiations, the peace treaty was completed. The Allies gave it to a German delegation on May 7, 1919. The head of the delegation objected immediately. He said the treaty was unfair. He urged his government not to sign it. At first, Germany did not sign. The leader of the government refused and resigned in protest. But a new government was formed, and its leader signed the document at a ceremony at the palace in Versailles outside Paris. Finally, World War I was officially over.
President Woodrow Wilson returned to the United States after the treaty signing ceremony. He was not completely satisfied with the treaty, yet he believed it was still valuable because it established the League of Nations. Wilson's battle for the League was only half over when the treaty was signed in Europe. He had to win approval from the United States Senate. That half of the battle would not be easy.
Part of the problem was political. Wilson was a member of the Democratic Party. The Senate was controlled by the Republican Party. Also, Wilson had refused to name any important Republicans to his negotiating team at the peace conference. Part of the problem was personal. A number of senators disliked Wilson. One was Republican Senator Henry Cabot Lodge. Lodge was the powerful chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He told a friend he never expected to hate anyone as much as he hated Wilson.
Wilson spoke before the Senate just 2 days after he returned from Europe. He urged it to approve the peace treaty. Wilson said, "The united power of free nations must put a stop to aggression, and the world must be given peace. Shall we and any other free people refuse to accept this great duty? Dare we reject it and break the heart of the world? We cannot turn back. America shall show the way. The light streams upon the path ahead and nowhere else."
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee began hearings on the treaty. It heard a number of people who opposed the League of Nations. They said the League would destroy the freedom and independence of the United States. The committee completed its hearings and prepared a report for the full Senate. The report said the United States should reject the treaty unless changes were made. The committee proposed almost 40 changes.
The committee's report was a blow to President Wilson, both politically and personally. He had worked extremely hard to win Europe's support for the idea of a League of Nations. Great crowds in Paris had cheered him and his idea. Now, the Senate of his own country was about to reject it. Wilson decided he must take his case out of the hands of the people's representatives. He would take the case directly to the people themselves. He would build public support for the treaty. If enough citizens supported it, he believed, the Senate could not reject it.
President Wilson planned a speaking trip all across the country. His family and his doctor urged him not to go. They said he was still weak from a recent sickness. But Wilson refused the advice. He said the treaty was more important to him than his own life. The president left Washington in early September. He traveled in a special train. In city after city, he made speeches and rode in parades. He shook thousands of hands. At times, he suffered from a painful headache. But there was no time to rest.
Everywhere Wilson stopped, he urged the people to support the League of Nations. It was, he said, the only hope for peace. In Boulder, Colorado, 10,000 people waited to hear him. By then, Wilson was extremely weak. He had to be helped up the steps of the building where he was to speak. He made the speech. He said he was working to honor the men who had died in the war. He said he was working for the children of the world.
Wilson put all his heart and energy into his speeches. And as his family and doctor had warned, the pressure was too great. While in Wichita, Kansas, the pain in his head became terrible. He could not speak clearly. His face seemed frozen. A blood vessel had broken in his brain. Wilson had suffered a stroke. The president was forced to return to Washington. His condition got worse every day. Soon, he was unable to move. Woodrow Wilson would spend the rest of his presidency as a terribly sick man.
And that's our show. Thanks for joining us.